Hi, everyone. I'm Len Wilder, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here sober through a loving God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, I've got goosebumps. My cup runneth over. There's nothing like it on the face of the earth in this alcoholic's life. Absolutely nothing. The greatest single happening in my lifetime is Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I never want to forget from whence I cometh. Dick, thank you for giving me the privilege to be here this weekend for the 50th prepaid Georgia State Convention. Thank you, Alan and Teresa, for hosting me. Lynn and Becky, for your kindness. I talked to you on the phone before I came, and you've been wonderful since I've been here. The entire committee, and I don't know how many of you in here have ever been involved in convention work or service work, but if you haven't, you need to be, because a lot of work goes on, and I want to thank all the people. And there are a lot of people that didn't stand and didn't get credit, but have been worker bees, and you're the people that are important in conventions like this. I was going to hold a moment for Searcy, and that's been done, because I had the great privilege of meeting him over 35 years ago, and I've known him for a lot of years. He died as a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, 56 or 57 years sober. He was 95 years young. Dick called me and said, "Len, can you come?" And I was running for an airplane, and I said, "I don't know. Let me talk to my wife." Because my thought was, we were going to be gone last weekend. I'm going to be gone the next two weekends in Texas and Canada. But on the way to the airport, I said, "Honey," they called, "and I've been invited to go to the Georgia State Convention." And she said, "You've got to go." I said, "Why?" I hadn't had this thought. And this is a lady that hadn't been in my life but 6.5 years. She said, "Because didn't the beginnings start with you in the state of Georgia?" I said, "Thank you." I got to Chicago, and at 5 a.m. in the morning, I left Dick a message, and I said, "I'll be here. And I want to thank you for that privilege." Because you see, it was a little over 41 years ago, on the south side of Atlanta, that I was crawled up in a fetal position, and there was a knock on the door, and I was at some motel on the south side, I don't know or don't remember which, and I was terrified. And I didn't open the door, and in a few minutes I heard a key go in the lock, and the door opened, and I heard a voice say, "Big shot, you want to stop drinking?" And I didn't know what I wanted, but there was a man named Joe Hubbard, and he was my Eskimo. I get emotional when I think about Joe. God love him. He's the one that carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And he told me about a year later, "Big shot, you've got some more drinking to do." And you know something? He was right. But I sat in those meetings in Atlanta, and I didn't want to be alcoholic, and I certainly didn't want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything you said went in one ear and out the other. And I wasn't seeing, and I wasn't hearing, and I didn't want to be. And you talk about all the things that happen to us if we continue to drink. And I said, "Not me, I'm different." And you know something, I absolutely believe that. Not me, I'm different. They talk about the loss of homes and jobs and families, the loss of health, the insanity that goes with our illness, the jails, the institutions, and I said, "Not me, I'm different." All of those things had to happen to me. Some had already happened. The rest had to happen to me over the next two-year period. And that's why I never want to forget from whence I cometh. And when I walked in here last night, and I'm sorry that I missed Bill because I haven't seen him in years, and I do remember him, and I'm sorry I missed Lily. But I was to hear that wonderful message from Scott last night and from his lovely wife, Linda, today, and thank God we've got people like them with the energy and the dedication in our program. Because I know that Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon are well. Everything that I am today, from the inside out, is as a direct result of a loving God in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a Californian by residence, a Kentuckian by birth, and an alcoholic by absorption. And I drank as much as I could for as long as I could, and I damn near died. I'm a liar, cheat, and a thief, and a con man, and a phony, and a user, and abuser of people. And I had a tendency to drink. One of my earliest memories was that I wanted to be a man. And my interpretation of a man was a guy that goes out in the world and competes, and there's no such thing as failure. And you know, I tried to do that for a lot of years, and to a lot of people outwardly, I was successful. The four C's really characterized my drinking. I drank in the beginning for comfort, then I drank for courage. Then I crossed that line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking, and I drank compulsively. And the end result was total corruption in every area of my life. And you see, I don't want to forget those things. I grew up in a family where I had a lot of love, probably too much. My story is one of drinking at both ends of the spectrum, because I came into the world with all of the advantages that a human could ever want in life or ever need in life. And I ended up on the streets of Los Angeles where no one knew or cared where I was. And that is where my disease took me. But they used to tell me, and I can remember this way, way back, whether it was school teachers or coaches, and they continue to tell me this. They used to say, "Lynn, you've got great potential." And they'd always include one word after that: "But." "You've got great potential, but." And you know something? They talked to me about my attitudes before they talked to me about my drinking. I did a lot of drinking in this state, and I want to talk about that tonight, and I do when I come back in the southeast, or I'm in Georgia. I was a user and abuser of everything around me, including people. I was given some athletic ability, and I abused and used that up. Someone talked, and our voice said before the meeting, and Chuck did say that, that if you take the Catholics and the Southern Baptists away, we wouldn't have many in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, half of that's true in my case. And I'm not a Catholic. But like a lot of you, I suspect, in this audience tonight, I was raised as a hard-shell, foot-washing, shouting, fighting, narrow-minded, deep-water Southern Baptist. But you know something? My religious upbringing, my environment, my parents, none of that had anything to do with my disease. But I blamed everyone and everything for a long, long time. I always said it was you. I was a traveling, running drunk, and I was always going to be different in Atlanta. It was always going to be different in Lexington. It was always going to be different in New York and Philadelphia and Miami and Fort Lauderdale. It was always going to be different in Dallas and Houston. It was always going to be different when I got out of the Phoenix jail. It was always going to be different in Mexico. It was always going to be different in the Caribbean. It was always going to be different. I've never had but two major problems in my lifetime. You're looking at one yet tonight, and the other was that bottle and some of those magic tablets. And I haven't had that problem for a long, long time, a day at a time. And I don't want to forget that. Everything was set up for me. But I tell you what my disease did, and your disease also. But my disease took everything away from me, near and dear. It took the benefits of a great education. It took all of my family. It took all of my friends. It took an athletic career. It took everything away from me. Everything, with no exceptions. I could talk about my youth and things that went on and everything, but I want to tell you that I got out of college. I did manage to do that. And as expected, I go in a family business. They were three generations old, and I turned my back on that to go out and to prove me to you. And I spent a lot of time trying to prove me to you. And after I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while, I discovered that I was desperately trying to prove me to me also. And out of college, I got a job with a company called Standard Oil Company. And you know, I got out of that structured environment. You know, ours is a disease of perception, drunk or sober. And my perception was, if I could just get out of this environment, I'll be free. And it was like letting midnight out of chute 9, because as soon as I got out of it, I couldn't get enough of what I loved. And that was drinking and carousing and everything that goes with it. And Standard Oil Company sent me to Birmingham. And the division manager over there made a very quick decision. I don't think I want him in this division, and they sent me to Atlanta. And I started to drink and to run and to do all the things, and all of a sudden they started to call me on the carpet to talk to me about my attitudes, but they also started to talk to me about my drinking. And they used to say things like, why do you drink the way you do? Why do you say the things you say? Act the way you act? And any time I thought they were about to find out about Lynn Wilder, I had to make a move. And it didn't matter whether it was a geographic move, a job move, a relationship move, I had to move. And I did a lot of that. I used to say I changed jobs a lot. Well, I did change jobs a lot out of necessity, because they fired me from those jobs as a direct result of my alcoholism, no less, no more. And I had gotten involved with a school in Atlanta because I was able, they pulled me in and put me in the division office of advertising and PR, and I was able to get the network for Standard Oil Company, which Texaco had a long, long time. And they fired me from Standard Oil Company, and a door opened up at this school in Atlanta, and they hired me. And here I was, they hired me in a capacity where I was the so-called leader of men every day and a drunk every night, the Jekyll and Hyde that we know so much about. And before long, they were asking me those same questions. Lynn, why do you drink the way you do? Why do you say the things you say and do the things you do? And I was able to last there about 8.5 months, and they had to let me go. And I know that it was hard on the man there that had to let me go, because we became lifelong friends. I ended up going back to my hometown. I had become willing, because I had no other choice, and going into that family business, and my disease was galloping. I looked around, and most of my friends were married and meeting their responsibility. At least that was my perception. So I decided what I needed to do was to get married, and unfortunately for the lovely lady I found, she married me. And we had a lovely baby daughter out of that marriage. And fortunately for them, they were able to get away from me and go back to Chicago. And I didn't see that daughter for 9.5 years as a direct result of my disease. And you know, I had to go on from there. And I was to end up with another company that hired me in New York, and they sent me back to Atlanta, and my disease had progressed to a point where no one wanted to be around me. I had gone to school with a group of guys from the Atlanta area, and they moved away from me. And one had the courage to come to me and to talk to me about it and say, Lynn, no one wants to be around you because of your actions. What's happened? And you know, I didn't know what to tell them. And I will tell you one story. Back then, we didn't have treatment facilities. Hazleton had just opened, but we didn't have any others. I ended up in the Peachtree Hospital, where I was put, and I was in bad shape. I had already developed something called DTs. Not only was the physical part of the illness beginning to really take its toll, and the one last thing I held on to, if I could stay in shape physically, I don't have a drinking problem. And I would be at the Atlanta Athletic Club playing basketball or playing handball, and I'd be back up in the bar drinking doubles. And I started to get put in private sanitariums. I ended up at the Peachtree Hospital one time, and that lady that was tough as nails came into the room one day, and I was young, and I said, I've got to leave here. She said, no, you don't. I said, yeah, I've got to get to the Kentucky Derby. You don't understand. She put her hands out right like this. She said, touch my hands. I wasn't shaking. I was vibrating. I couldn't even, and she said, you get back in that bed. But it went in one ear and out the other. And I had to continue like that until this company fired me as a direct result of my disease. I was a blackout drinker. And before I get it, a man came up to me today and said, are you going to tell the goat story tonight? And I never think about it until somebody reminds me of it. But this goes back. And this is a true story. And when I first came to Atlanta, I'd been here about a little less than a year with Standard Oil Company right out of college. I was living with two other guys, and they were in Emory Dental School. And I was drinking a lot, and I had started to black out. I was a periodic at blacking out at that point. But one of the guys was from McRae, Georgia, and he was in dental school, and his dad was the mayor of McRae. And his mother and father were going on a trip and were going to be out of town for about a week. So we put together a party that involved a lot of people in McRae for the weekend. It was all information week in the state of Georgia. And the Standard Oil had decided to send me to the part of Georgia, the south part of Georgia, to cover it and to go to all our dealers and to show up at certain things and to put banners out and give little talks and everything. And so I headed to McRae first. And we drank and partied all weekend. And on Sunday, we started to drink and everything, and I had to be in Columbus, Georgia on Monday morning. And the last thing I remember is getting in that company car to head to Columbus, Georgia. The next thing I remember is coming to the next morning, and I don't know whether you ever came to and you couldn't move your body. But I came to, and I was like paralyzed. And I heard a bell ring. And I was afraid to turn over in the bed. And then a few minutes later, I heard another bell ring. And it rang again, and I thought, that's coming from the bathroom. And finally, I turned over, and I saw that empty on the bureau, and the room was a mess. I had no idea where I was. I finally got up, sick as I could be, and I could hear movement in that bathroom. And I opened that door, and there in the bathtub, tied up, was a goat. Well, I've laughed about it for years, but I'm going to tell you something. I wasn't laughing about it that morning. I was so sick that I was dying, and the goat had a little bell on a collar around his neck. And he had totally ruined that tub and the petition, and I thought, and I did not know where I was. And I went to the front and looked out, and it was a gravel driveway, circular driveway, and I was in a motel. And I looked, and my company car was parked across the driveway. And I thought, what do I do? Well, I didn't have real good rational thinking, so I thought, I've got to get out of here. So the first thing I did was to put on a pair of pants and a shirt and go over and back that company car right up to the room over And I thought, I got to get this goat out of here. And I took the bed sheets off, and I tied them up, and I took that goat, and I thought, well, if I can tie the goat up in the sheets, I'll throw him in the trunk and get him out of here. I had no idea to this night, if there's anyone here from around that area and you missed the goat about 40 years ago, I publicly want to make my amends. That's one I've never been able to make. I got the trunk to the car up, I opened the motel door, I had the goat with sheets all around him, and I started out and I tripped. And the goat got loose, and his two front feet were still tied, but his back feet weren't. And he started across that gravel, and I started after him. And I fell, and I cut myself up badly and ripped my pants, and I got him, and I threw him in the trunk. And I left that motel. And I immediately headed out in the country, and I turned that goat out on a country road. And I have not seen that goat since. Now, I had to go back into town to figure out where I was, and I was in Perry, Georgia. But I was absolutely terrified. I was too terrified to go back to the front desk. But I got in that car, and I knew I had to be in Columbus, and then the committee that we all know about took off. And I was absolutely crazy. And I got to Columbus, and I said, I've got to do something, because they've got to know that I'm with Standard Oil Company. They'll call, and they'll fire me. And I called the motel, and I got the manager, and I told him I'd been in the room, and there'd been an accident in the bathroom, and whatever the bill was, to please send it to me. And I gave him my home address in Atlanta. And do you know something? He sent me that bill, and I was able to pay it. But just things like that. And you see, this is before I had a drinking problem. But I want to tell you my one last Georgia story, but God love Joe Hubbard and the other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had the great privilege of knowing a lot of the old-timers in Atlanta, even after I got sober, Clarence Roberts and of course, Joe. And Joe Phelan was a great friend of mine. He spent a lot of nights in our home in Laguna. He loved Chuck, and he would come out a lot. I've spent time in their home, the whole Phelan family. I loved all those people. Thank God for the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I love... That's why I love the old-timers meetings. Because the old-timers are the ones that put me back together. In December of 1963, I came to one day... And I had no idea where I was, but I looked over and there was no doorknob on my side of the room. And there were four other empty beds. I was to find out that I was in Milledgeville, Georgia. And I want to tell you that 40 years ago, it wasn't what it is today. It was the Georgia State Nut House. And I was there as the direct result of my disease, no less, no more. And they didn't separate the alcoholics from the others. I was a number of the state of Georgia. And I was as scared as I'd ever been in my life. And I was terrified that I'd never get out. And as I stand here tonight, I don't remember them ever saying anything about our disease or the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But so what? I had already been introduced to AA. But the way they treated us in there, and you've heard some conversation about it today, particularly at the old-timers meeting, they gave you massive doses of Librium and Thorazine. And they gave you enough Thorazine in there where if you got up and down the hall in a day, you had a hell of a day. And there was a lady in there that followed me around that had no teeth and called me her son and followed me everywhere I went. Somebody asked me today about my son, and I'll talk about my adult children. I'll tell this story real quick, because If you've ever been in any of those type institutions, you know they always had crafts for those of us. I want to tell you that I came into the world before I even took a drink. I had no craft ability. I'm going to go out of the world with no craft ability. When they put me in those institutions, it was worse. Because in Milledgeville, they had, they had simulated leather. They had the holes numbered. And we'd sit at a table, and if you could hold your head up long enough and stay awake, you'd start to put the leather through the holes to make those little coin purses. The staff had to always help me because I never could finish. Now I want to go forward many years to where I had had three children, my youngest of whom is my son. And we in California, and I'd been sober some time, have something, and I know you have it wherever you are, called Indian Guides. And Jim and I were in Indian Guides, and I was traveling a lot then. And he loved it. And I came home one night to Laguna. I'd been in New York for about 4 or 5 days on business, and I walked in the house, and he ran up to me very excited and said, "Dad, guess what?" And I said, "What, Jim?" He said, "We've got the project for next month's Indian Guides." I said, "That's terrific." I said, "What are we going to do?" He said, "We're going to show them how to make coin purses." I said, "I tell you something, Jim. I'm going to finance it, and you're going to show them how to do it." This is a young boy, too, that I was doing. I was traveling a lot then, and I was doing a lot of developing in Florida and traveling all over. I'd come home. Pam and I had married, and we had those two young ones. My oldest daughter, we had brought back to Laguna, and I'd sometimes come home. I'd change luggage, and I'd go somewhere to participate in a convention. And Pam would say to me, "Lynn, you don't spend any time with the children," and she was right. And I was home one weekend, and I had to go out about 20 miles out of where we lived to look at a project and one Saturday morning, and she said, "Why don't you take Jim with you?" And he was about 4 years old. And I put him in the front seat, and, you know, I really didn't know how to talk to him. And we started to ride out, and I was talking to him back and forth a little bit, and I finally turned to him and I said, "Jim, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And he said, "Daddy, I want to be a fire truck." I said, "No, honey, maybe what you mean is you want to be a fireman." He said, "Yeah, I'd like to be that too." Then he hesitated for a minute, and he turned to me and said, "Daddy, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And I didn't have an answer for him. But I remember those precious moments. But I had to go on from Georgia to the point where everyone in my life that had tried to help me had given up. And the greatest thing that ever happened to me was when my family said, "That's it." And they weren't in Al-Anon, but they let me loose. And I was to get off an airplane in 1964 in Los Angeles, and as I got off the airplane, I came out of a blackout. And I never want to forget the next 7 months because they were spent on the streets of Los Angeles as the direct result of my disease, no less, no more. And you see, that isn't the way I'd come into the world. And I was to have two seizures there. I was to panhandle. I was to sleep in MacArthur Park. I was to be in and out of halfway houses because wine had become my necessity. It had become my drink of choice. Because, you see, I didn't want to be an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up at the Cecil Hotel in Los Angeles one more time, which is a Skid Row hotel, living in a room with two other winos, and I was put on the street. Not by the hotel, but by the two winos. And a social worker was to find me and knew that I was in bad shape, and I was physically, because the physical part of the disease had finally beat me into absolute oblivion. And she was to say, "Where can I take you?" And I knew there was no place I could go unless I went back to MacArthur Park. And there was a man that ran a little flea bag motel. He was not an alcoholic. He'd been a staff sergeant, and he had retired, and he would always give me a bed, and I said, "Take me there." And she did that, and one more time, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous was there, and I never want to forget. Because two men got a key, they were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and walked in that room. And they were to take me out of that motel and put me in a sanitarium in Los Angeles. And 3 days later, a doctor stood at my bed telling me the things I'd heard before. I had no idea that a surrender had taken place in my life. I had no idea that I'd had my last drink. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. I knew that there was no God, because if there were a God, why was I in the shape that I was in? I cried out in silent desperation to no one in particular. I was to stay in that place because I was in bad shape physically for the better part of 2 weeks, and they took me out of there and they took me back to a recovery home, and I was to stay under this doctor's care for the next 3.5 months. And I was incapable of doing anything except not taking a drink, and I didn't even know whether I was capable of doing that or not. They put me in the kitchen. They found very quickly I couldn't wash dishes because I literally vibrated. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do anything. I finally got to the point where I'd stay in that kitchen and I could dry dishes. I would sit in a meeting at noon. I would be in a meeting at night. I was submersed in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was so rummy that I didn't know. I was taken to a meeting. It was one of the oldest meetings in Los Angeles. I had about a month of sobriety, called the Arlington Group, and I was to hear a man talk, and the only thing I got out of that was, no man can live like that man can live. No human can possibly live the way he talked. I had no idea who he was. I was to hear him again in a couple of weeks at another meeting, and then I was taken to the Beverly Hills Men's Stag one night. And he came over and sat down next to me. And he said, "Son, how you doing?" And I said, "I don't know." And he wrote his name down. He wrote Chuck C. And he gave me a phone number. He said, "I want you to come down to my office." He said, "Where are you living?" I said, "I'm living at the Bimini." And I didn't call him. And within the next few weeks, I went to another meeting because somebody told me he was speaking, and they gave me a pass, and I caught a bus, and I transferred, and I showed up at that meeting. And he sat down next to me, and he said, "You didn't call me." And he said, "If you don't call me tomorrow, I'm going to call Pat Wigger, who was the founder of that foundation of which that recovery house was one that I was in." And I was terrified of that man. So I called him. I had no idea who he was. I just knew that he would come by that recovery house at night after he'd worked all day, and he'd put me in his car, and he would take me wherever he was going. And he would share his experience, strength, and hope. And he would talk to me about the old-timers. He would talk to me about Ebby and Bill and Dr. Bob. He'd talk about Lois. He'd talk about he and Elsa and their experiences. And I just listened and I took it all in. And I was finally released from that doctor's care, and I was able to move out to an area in Los Angeles called the San Fernando Valley. And I went to meetings morning, noon, and night, because that's all I was capable of doing. I was unemployed, unemployable. Finally, a group of old-timers surrounded me one night at a speaker meeting on a Friday night, and they said, "Len, we've been watching you." And I thought, "Uh-oh, I'm in trouble." And they said, "We think you should get a job." And you know what my mind said? Well, I ought to tell them that I'm putting a resume together, which I was not. So they told me exactly how to get a job. They told me to get the Los Angeles Times out, to go down the column, to call, to set up interviews, and the first person that offered me a job say, "Yes, I can do it." I said, "Yes, I can do that, but you know something? I couldn't. I could call on a good day and set up an interview, but I couldn't show up. On a not-so-good day, I'd call. If you'd answer the phone, I'd hang up. And they'd ask me nightly, 'How's the job search going?' I said, 'Terrific. I had 2 interviews today. I'd had none.' They knew it. I didn't know they knew it. They let that go for about 2 weeks. They came to me one night, and they finally said, 'It's apparent to us you can't get a job.' I said, 'I got a job offer today.' They said, 'What company?' I said, 'Pacific Mutual Life Insurance Company.' They were advertising all over the Los Angeles Times. I'd never darkened their doors. These guys didn't miss a step. They said, 'Len, that's fine, but in the interim, we found a job for you.' The job was as a janitor in that church 3 days a week. And you know, I got fired from that job. I got up the next morning, and I was living with 2 sober alcoholics, and I'd walked 2.5 miles to the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And I started down Vineland Avenue, and I looked in a little service station window that said, 'Help wanted.' I walked in there to the manager. I said, 'I saw your sign.' He said, 'I'm looking for someone to pump gas on the swing shift. Can you do it?' Now, you see, I wanted to tell him that I'd been with Standard Oil Company and that I'd been all these things and yakety yakety yak, you know, because I always wanted you to think I was somebody that I was not. But for some reason, you taught me enough to where I said, 'Yes, I can do it.' And I went to work pumping gas on the swing shift. And when I wasn't pumping gas, I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what had happened? I had gotten in the program. And the night manager came to me shortly thereafter and said he had to let me go. And I said, 'Why aren't I doing a good job?' He said, 'Len, you're the best man we have, but you're not bondable.' It all had to do with something called alcoholism. I don't care what's going on in your life. If you're relatively new here, if you'll stay around here a day at a time and do what all of us do, everything that's going on in your life will change. I'll promise you that, because it has in my life. Someone then suggested I sell encyclopedias. I said, 'I can do that.' But you know, I had so much fear going in my life that I could not. Fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of abandonment. That fear, that raw fear. A men's stag meeting that I went to, 2 men came up to me one night. They said, 'Len, we're going on a men's retreat of all alcoholic men this weekend. You're going with us.' You didn't say why or where or when back there. You did it. They said, 'You bring a toothbrush and a razor, a change of clothes, a bathing suit.' I said, 'I don't have a bathing suit.' I said, 'How much is it? I don't have any money.' They said, 'It won't cost you anything.' I had no idea where we were going. 3 men picked me up. I was on the curb. They started talking about we're going to a Jesuit retreat house. They started talking about the Jesuit and this. My mind told me, 'My God, they're taking me to a Catholic retreat. They're going to try to convert me.' I'll never forget rolling up that hill in 1965 to Manresa, and those 2 giants stood there in full black robes, and I was scared to death. One of them was Father Frank Parrish, who I call every year on my birthday. He's a non-alcoholic. He's an incredible man. He's in his 90s now. The other was an alcoholic priest named Father Barney Nixon. That man led me out of the wilderness. He was one of many. But he was the greatest teacher of the 12 steps that I've ever encountered. Thank God for him, because we bonded, and he literally, hand in hand, continued to lay the foundation of sobriety for me. And things like that continued to happen in my life. I never want to forget that the first year I was sober, my total income was $1,237, and I was overpaid. My second year of sobriety, I was sitting in West Los Angeles at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the most beautiful lady I'd ever seen in my life, ever. She was tall and blonde, drop-dead gorgeous, and she walked to the podium to read chapter 5, and it's a program of attraction, and I wanted what she had. Her name was Pamela Floyd. She had gotten sober in her mid-20s also. Her name became Pamela Floyd Wilder. We fell in love. We had an incredible life together. That daughter I talked to you that I had right out of college, I didn't see for 9.5 years. I had to go back. She was living with her grandparents and her mother in Chicago and make those amends. And I'll never forget getting in the cab that night and just closing my eyes and saying, God, it's in your hands, as I went to the north side. And she walked out of that background, and I broke down and sobbed. And I went to dinner that night with both she and her mother, and I made my amends across that table. And I looked at that daughter, and her name is Gail, and I said, all I want to be is your friend. Now, you see, you'd given me that gift because I'm a taker. You had taught me the gift of giving. You had also shown me how to take expectations off of situations and people. She came into our home shortly thereafter, and she's been in California a lot of years. She graduated from college out there. Her mother brought her new family out. Pam was there, and we'd had two little ones by then, and they were growing up. And I sat between Pam and Gail's mother. And as Gail walked up on that stage to get her diploma, her mother turned to me and said, Lynn, I can't thank you enough for what you've done for Gail. And I turned to her mother and I said, don't thank me. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, I know that nothing would be possible in my life without Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God. She's gone on. She's went to law school. She's been practicing law in Los Angeles for a long time. I talk to her today. I talk to her all the time. She's a lovely, lovely woman. Pam and I had our first child in Los Angeles. We moved to Laguna Beach in early 1972. And Jim, our son, was born there. And life was good. Pam was very involved, very, very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was. She got involved in Al-Anon. The second year that I was in AA, my original sponsor sent me to Al-Anon and said, you must go to 6 meetings. I went to 6 meetings and went in one ear and out the other because I didn't need it. What I need Al-Anon for? I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll talk a little more about that in a minute. In 1984, I talked on a Saturday night in Florida. Ramona, my great friend, my great Al-Anon friend from Oklahoma, was there with me. She said, let's call Pam, and we went to the room and called Pam, and she was home with all the children. She said, I've got a lower back pain. It's nothing. I'm soaking in the tub. 10.5 months later, she was dead. It was leukemia. You surrounded us. Because we spent most of that next 10.5 months at the UCLA Medical Center. She got in remission twice. Every day, I got on my knees and I asked God to enable me to do what I could for that lady, and He did that. I had horrendous business problems. I was leveraged to the hilt. A huge project that we'd had going had gone upside down, and that had nothing to do with anything other than that was going on in my life. And I asked God every day to let me reach out and to help her. And the beautiful part about it is He allowed us to complete that relationship in a loving way with the children. And we were all there on October the 16th in 1985 when she stepped into the next room. Interestingly enough, that was Thursday of this week. My mother died in 1963, a young woman also, on that same day, October the 16th. And they were two great, great women in my life that showed me a lot and taught me a lot. Pam taught me a lot about intimacy. I knew nothing about how to have a relationship. She was a great teacher for me. And I love her dearly. We would never have been together if it hadn't been for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Life goes on. I had no idea what the mothers of the world do, but I was to learn very quickly. And those kids started to grow up, and you'd given me the gift of openness and honesty in this program, and I was able to crawl up with those kids at night and sit on the bed and share with them and listen to them. Willingness has been a key for me in all areas of my life. I had problems. I became willing one more time. I got another opportunity to take a job where I had to get up at 4:30 every morning and drive 60 miles each way on the freeways. And every morning that I'd hit that freeway, I'd say, "Thank you, God, for the opportunity. Thank you, God, for the opportunity." And you know, a lot of things have happened. Those kids have grown up. They've all gotten good educations. They've gone on with life. I'm very close to all of them. I love them dearly. I had an experience like Scott shared last night with my middle daughter. Seattle, 1990, the International Convention. I had the great privilege to participate in that convention. About 40 of us left that convention and went to the San Juan Islands. The first night we were on Orcas Island, we were celebrating two AA birthdays. I walked out of the men's room. The maitre d' said, "You've got an emergency phone call." I said, "No, it must be for one of the members of the group." He said, "No, it's for you." I picked that phone up, and it was that daughter's aunt saying she had tried to take her life, and they didn't. She was in Hogue Hospital in intensive care, and they didn't know if she were going to make it. I couldn't get off that island that night, but I want to tell you that you were all there, Al-Anons and AAs. You stayed up all night. We had a prayer vigil. I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen over and over and over and over again. A little plane came in the next morning. I got on it, just me and the pilot. I flew to SeaTac to go home. I just looked up and said, "God, it's in your hands. Thy will be done." She made it. She's a fine young lady today. She went on and finished college. I walked her down the aisle a little over a year ago, early last year. 5 months ago, she gave us our first grandson. The power of love and God, the two most healing forces in the world. You know? I went back to work in the corporate world 8 years ago. A man called me that was head of this company and said, "I need some help in site development." And I said, "John, I'll come help you for 6 months." One more time, I got up and commuted to downtown Los Angeles. I'm still there today. I didn't plan on that. But you know, I've learned not to make plans. But every day I thank Him each morning for the opportunity. And I ask God every morning to enable me to reach out and to help someone who's suffering and in need. Because you see, as you know and as I know, what we're all about is love and service. And it's been shown to me through the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over again. And that's the simplicity of it. Someone asked me to talk about the early days and a couple of experiences I had, and I will very quickly do that. I will tell you, and I can't tell you what year it was, but Pam and I were invited to speak at the Atlanta Roundup. I can tell you that it was the year of the World's Fair in Knoxville. Now, whatever year that was, I don't know, because we had dropped our children in Lexington and had come to Atlanta. Joe Hubbard was there. He said to me on Friday night, meet me for breakfast in the morning at 7 o'clock. Pam and I got up and met Joe, and he had Lois there with him. The four of us went to Stone Mountain that day. What a day. I'll never forget Lois climbing around with all of us. I mean, Hubbard didn't do anything. He sat in the car and directed us, but the three of us, we climbed all around. And I'll never forget that, those experiences. I had the real privilege of becoming real close to that lady. She spent time in our home in Laguna Beach. And the people from, in the end, the people from Fishkill, New York, that used to take her everywhere, called me and said, Lois isn't doing well. If you're coming this way, she'd love to see you. And I had the privilege of going back about 8 months before she died and spending 2 days with her. I have had the great privilege of being with two women, two Al-Anon women, that had more strength and courage than any two human beings I've ever known. And Lois Wilson was one, and Elsa Chamberlain was the other. And what a privilege for me. I told Chuck, when he used to tote me around everywhere, that I'd love to meet Bill. Right after I was in my third year of sobriety, I got a phone call from him. I hadn't moved to Laguna Beach yet. He said to me, Elsa and I are going to be in Connecticut in such and such a weekend, and we're going into New York, and I'm going to spend the afternoon with Bill, and if you get back there, you could spend some time with us. Well, I mean, I got up out of that chair, and I was floating. I got a red-eye ticket round trip to New York, and I'll never forget that day. I spent the afternoon listening to those two men all afternoon. They invited me to go to dinner with them that night. Bill and Elsa, Chuck. Bill and Lois, Chuck and Elsa. I left that restaurant and went to LaGuardia and flew home. You know, I could have come home without an airplane. For the real privilege. About 8 months later, I was going back to New York, and I asked Papa, I said, should I call Bill? He said, you better call him. I called him ahead of time. He said, come to the office. I got to the office, and he'd ordered sandwiches for us. And I was able to spend about 2.5 hours with him, and he talked to me about the traditions. He loved the traditions, and I don't have time. I'm sure you all know the story of the bill and the traditions and getting them approved. Wasn't easy. Thank God for that privilege. I stood in Miami in 1970, like it was yesterday, and watched them bring him up to that podium and think that he was going to expire right there. And watch him just come alive and life come out of him. Thank God for Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith. Thank God for Chuck Chamberlain, Elsa Chamberlain. Thank God for Lois Wilson and all of the old-timers. Because you see, they laid the foundation for all of us. Life has gone on. I'll tell you very quickly about a new pair of glasses. I was very privileged to be able to be one of the two people that put that retreat together at Palo Mesa in 1975. We'd been trying to get Chuck to do it for a long, long time. He finally agreed. Our Wednesday night speakers meeting, which was Chuck's meeting in Laguna Beach at the Women's Club, the Wednesday before we were going to Palo Mesa, I turned to Hal Dyke, who was Chuck's age and dear friend, and he and I had put that retreat together. And I said, Hal, we ought to tape this. He said, no. He said, he'll be asked to do, once he does one, he'll be asked to do hundreds of these. And he said, it's too late to get a taper anyway. I said, well, we've got Heine that tapes this message, this meeting. Heine was a little man that loved AA better than life itself. And we've all got people in our lives like that. He was a very humble servant. He had a little cassette. He didn't have fancy taping equipment. He would put it up on the podium right here. He was a janitor at a church. His wife loved Al-Anon. Her name was Leona. She worked in the school cafeteria and she cut ladies' hair on Saturday. Hal Dyke looked at me and said, "Who would you get?" I said, "I'll ask Honey." He said, "Do what you want." I went to Honey that night and I said, "Honey, we want you to go to Palomason and tape Chuck this weekend." He said, "Oh, I can't do that." He said, "I have to help Leona on Saturday." I said, "You go home tonight, you ask Leona, and call me in the morning." He called me Thursday morning and said, "How much is it?" I said, "You'll be our guest." I picked Papa up and I picked Heine up and we went to Palomason. We put Chuck at a little table up on a little platform. Heine put that little cassette up there and taped it. Super Bowl Sunday, 1975. I had Papa in the front seat. I had Heine in the back seat and we're going home. I turned to Chuck and I said, "I've never heard you the way you were this weekend. You're going to be asked to do hundreds of these." He said, "Son, I'll never do another one." I said, "What? Why?" He said, "I said everything that I've ever wanted to say." And you know, he never did another one. And a man that wanted to stay anonymous in our area came up with the idea, "Let's get it transcribed." And a man I'd sponsored had moved to Northern California, and he knew all about that. And he commuted to Laguna Beach, back and forth, till that book came into form, and this man did the underwriting. And it came into being, a new pair of glasses. Now, I'll very quickly tell you how I got that name. Father Fowle, one time in St. Louis, had heard Chuck give a talk. He had just met Elsa, this was years ago, and the three of them had lunch together. Father Fowle looked at Elsa and he said, "Now tell me your story, I just heard his." And Elsa started to talk and to share. And after she'd finished, he took his glasses and wiped them off. And he looked at the two of them and he said, "You know, it's just like a new pair of glasses." And that's the title of that book. And we got Clancy to write the foreword. And thank God we've got that book. The only thing I can tell you, if you don't have a copy of it and haven't read it, please get it. Because it's him. And I'm so grateful that I was able to have men like that in my life for so many years. I want to tell you that I talked to my son today who's in Boston, who's an incredible young man. He's a great achiever. He's done everything. I'm so proud of him. He's got 120 days today. Had a real tough time with him. But I want to tell you something. 18 years ago, the day after Thanksgiving coming, I had a whole group for Thanksgiving dinner, a lot of different factions. And I knew I'd been in trouble for a long, long time. Because you see, I have something that's easily deniable called control in my life. And I thought everything that I was doing for my family, for my business partner, for members of Alcoholics Anonymous, for anyone, was really in your best interest. That's very subtle. That's very subtle denial is what that is. And I knew I had this. And I knew I was in trouble with him the day after Thanksgiving. I called my dear friend, and she had become really a surrogate mother to me, Elsa. And we had lunch. And she laughed a lot, and she was one that her whole philosophy of living was stay on the light side. And she looked across the table at me that day in Laguna Beach, and she said, "Len, I think you better turn yourself into Al-Anon." And you want to know something? I went into that group that she started in her home a week from Monday, we will celebrate the 45th anniversary of that group. And there weren't men in that group. It was a big group that had moved from her home to a big facility in Laguna Beach. And I didn't go in there as someone that had almost 22 years of sobriety. I went in there as a newcomer. And I want to tell you, there's some black belt Al-Anons in that group. Some of them are still there. And I want to tell you that since that day, I have become a regular member of Al-Anon, and what that program has done for me is incredible. It's taken me to a deeper level. And I'm awfully proud of that. And if you're ever in my area on Monday, I'll take you to that meeting. Or I'll take you to my men's stag Al-Anon meeting that meets in Laguna Beach that we started 16 years ago. A group of sober alcoholics came to me and said, "Lynn, we think you ought to start an Al-Anon meeting." I said, "What?" I said, "Are you kidding me? I'm too new. I'm not about to try to start anything." But they kept talking about it, so I went to an old men's stag. It's still there. It's the largest men's stag, I think, in California. It now meets at the Crystal Cathedral. And we got about 8 Al-Anons. Not double winners. We got solid Al-Anons to come down and help us start that group. And I want to tell you that's the best meeting I go to every week. And I'm so grateful for this program. And that's helped me tremendously with my son, with everything in my life. Because you see, it's about relationships. I was 19 years sober and a man asked me one night, "Lynn, what kind of a relationship do you have with yourself?" I said, "Terrific." Because you see, that's my M.O. I was coming back from way down one night alone. I'd been sharing at a meeting in East San Diego County, and I got to thinking about that, and I said, "Lynn, what kind of a relationship do you really have with yourself?" And I became willing one more time to get vulnerable and to take a look at that. I'm going to tell you, for this human being, the two most important relationships in my life is the one I have with my God and the one I have with myself. And if those are in place, then things are good in my life, and today things are good in my life. Things are real good in my life. All because of the love and the caring and the foundations of the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen. And I could give a half a talk tonight on my involvement with Al-Ateen groups, where I was privileged to be a sponsor for a number of years. And listen to Helen this afternoon. She talked about the Harkins from Texas City that I knew well. And they both have gone on. But they both were so involved in Al-Ateen. And I'll never forget the first time I was asked to come to the Texas Al-Ateen Convention in early 70s. But if you want to know something about real honesty, go listen to some of those Al-Ateens. They're incredible. But the opportunities and the teachings that have been here for me and have been here for all of us are unbelievable. You see, we're all on the same path. Some of us a little ahead, some of us a little behind, and that isn't important. The important thing is that we're all on the path together. They told me when they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles to tell the truth. And I said, "Which truth?" I don't even have to think about that today, because you've shown me the truth and I know the truth. And I'm so grateful. I'm so very, very grateful for the gift of sobriety. And I'm going to close with a story that I always close with, because it really sums up what I'm trying to share tonight. And it's the story of a man that owned a fine Swiss watch, and he loved it more than any possession he'd ever had. And it quit running on him one day, and he would wind it, and it would run for a while, and then it would stop, and he would wind it, and it would stop, and he finally took it to a watchmaker. And the watchmaker repaired it, and then it stopped again, and he went through a series of watchmakers, and he knew not what else to do. And one morning, very early, he was sitting in his little den. He had his desk lamp on. And one more time, he was winding that watch. And as he turned it over and started to put it on his wrist, he noticed what he thought were a couple of small scratches. And he got his magnifying glass out, and he looked at it very closely. And they weren't scratches at all. It was a small inscription. And it said very simply, in case of trouble, return to Maker. And you know I love that. In case of trouble, return to Maker. Because God could and would and does. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. And most of all, I love all of you. Thank you.